PPI.org.
Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research assistant. Good evening, Charlene.
Good evening, everyone.
And if you want to be on my email list, a reminder, you can email me at disabilityandprogress, all written out, at samjasmine.com, S-A-M-J-A-S-M-I-N-E.com. Tonight, MS, or multiple sclerosis, and we have Nikki Foster in the studio. Good evening, Nikki.
Good evening, Sam.
Thank you so much for coming back.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Nikki is just, she couldn't get enough of us, and she came back to share her wealth of information. So we're very excited to have her, so thank you very much. Nikki, can we start out by just, can you give us a definition of what is MS or multiple sclerosis?
Yes, I can. And I would just preface this by saying I am not a doctor. So,
that's okay.
Just know that anything I say is what I've learned along this journey. And so multiple sclerosis is a chronic degenerative disease of the central nervous system. And our central nervous system is our brain, spinal cord, and the optic nerve. And it controls everything, really, when you think about it. It controls our breathing, our eating, our movement. It's considered an autoimmune disease. There's a lot that they're still learning about MS, but they do know that there's some sort of immune event that triggers MS. And in many cases, what happens is, you know, you have, let's say you get sick. In my case, I had a surgery. And so your immune system is working really hard to fight something, but it doesn't know the difference between good cells and bad cells. And so as it's fighting the infection, it starts to attack good cells. And for MS, it attacks the coating of the nerve called myelin. Mm-hmm. So if you think about your iPhone charger and the coating that covers it, it basically eats away at that lining. And so it leaves behind scars or the sclerosis, and then the multiples that you typically have many. And so that is with multiple sclerosis is really what it is that degeneration of those nerves, mm-hmm, that causes the symptoms and the challenges.
Talk a little more about the symptoms.
Absolutely. So MS is different for everybody. I mean, it's one of those diseases that is kind of considered a snowflake disease because it can really present itself in so many different ways. But the symptoms can range from weakness, muscle weakness, vision loss, tremors, mm-hmm, and spasticity or kind of tightening of the muscles. There can be bladder issues. Just numbness and tingling is another common symptom of MS, as well as fatigue. Fatigue is usually one of the symptoms that will bring people to really know something is wrong, because it's a fatigue that's really hard to put into words. It's a very overwhelming fatigue. It's not, I take a nap, I wake up, I feel great. It's, I take a nap and feel like I need to just find the next couch to lie down on and continue sleeping. So that fatigue is very, very common as well. And I think that fatigue, you know, your body is fighting itself every, mm-hmm, minute of every day, because it's really trying to, to kind of correct itself on this immune system. And so it just causes this overwhelming fatigue. There can also be cognitive changes and emotional changes that happen with MS. In a lot of cases, it sort of depends on where the lesion or the sclerosis, that scab that I talked about, that, mm-hmm, that happens when there's an attack on a certain part of the nerve. It depends on where that lands. And it's, okay, so, because that's what makes it such a confusing disease for doctors and patients, really, because there's, you know, a lot of parts of your nervous system that it's that it can present in. And so it partly depends on where those lesions might land. And that is just up to chance, really. There's no predictive ways of knowing how that happens. And so those are a few of the symptoms, again, ranging for everybody. The one symptom that I think of as being pretty common with people with MS is some of the emotional parts. So the unpredictability of it and just not knowing, you know, when you'll have another relapse, mm-hmm. what that relapse will entail, how and if your body will recover from those. Because, you know, and I'll talk about this, I think, probably a little bit later, but as you go through relapses, sort of your healing from that is just, it's uncertain. And so I think that uncertainty and that unpredictable nature of the disease is something that everyone with MS lives with every day.
So, you know, fatigue is like a lot of things have fatigue attached to them. So how do you go about diagnosing?
Right. So the diagnosis of MS, I think, because it does present itself as so many different, could be so many different diseases. And even, you know, fatigue can be, I just had a child and I've got, you know, a 2-year-old at home and I'm tired from chasing after
them.
Right? Exactly. So, so really the diagnosis process can be a frustrating one because you know something is wrong. There isn't kind of a checklist, if you will, for MS in the doctor's office. And so diagnosis can be just a different process for everyone. I've heard many stories from my friends with MS that, you know, it can take as long as 10 years where, and I know for, you know, I think I've probably had it a lot longer before my official diagnosis. And so a doctor will kind of, I think, after looking at a host of symptoms, they'll send you for an MRI scan and sort of taking a look at that central nervous system and seeing if there's any of those scars is how it's suspected. And then they typically confirm an MS diagnosis through a spinal tap because there is some spinal fluid. Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's not an easy
It probably
process.
Sounds like it is.
Yes, it is something I would not wish on my worst enemy because it's a very painful process, both having it done, but then also the recovery can be very challenging. And so, but that's how they confirm the diagnosis. And they're really working hard at speeding up the diagnosis process because it can really impact how the course of the disease for people, if you're able to get on a treatment faster or things like that. And so they've really been changing the diagnostic protocols in recent years and with a lot of input from physicians and patients. And I think that's great progress to get to the diagnosis faster. It's also around raising awareness with physicians. You know, a general practice doctor may not have a specialty in MS because it does kind of have that specialty nature. And so raising awareness of symptoms to really kind of raise red flags and get people to that diagnosis faster.
Right.
And so just like the disease, everyone's got a unique story, but that's typically how they diagnose it.
So Nikki, you had your own introduction and that's why you're back on. When we first interviewed you, you were pretty new. We were talking about that, and you were pretty new to it. now you've had a little chance. I'd love to hear, like, kind of your story. Like, how did you discover and what that was like for you?
Absolutely. So I was introduced to running by my baby sister and started running following her lead, if you will, because she really talked about what a great, great thing it was for her to, you know, de-stress and health-wise. And so I took that up and one of my good friends and I spent 2013 running a race every month.
Wow. And then
at different lengths. And I was like, I never thought I would be a runner. I wasn't quite yet 40, but I was approaching it pretty fast. So this was something I took on, you know, later in life, a young age still, but it wasn't something I had started doing in my youth. And so it was just great and enjoyed it. In 2014, my friend and I were going to be, you know, turning 40. So we decided to challenge ourselves and run a half marathon. So we trained for that during 2014. And so we did that in October of 2014, ran a half marathon in St. Paul. And about a month later, I was walking into work and my right leg gave out from under me. I couldn't control my ankle and I couldn't control my knee. And it was very frightening and very puzzling because I was, thought of myself as a runner.
Right.
And suddenly didn't have this muscle control. And so I remember, just kind of using the walls to get into an office and call my husband and talk through what to do. And I went to a general practice doctor and he diagnosed it as a pinched nerve in my lower back from running.
Oh, if it only was.
Right, right. And so with that in mind, I thought, well, I'll just go to the physical therapy that he's recommended and everything will be great and I'll be back to running. And during that time, things just went from bad to worse. And one day I couldn't control my leg to the point where I couldn't move my foot from the gas pedal to the brake. And that was very frightening. And my physical therapist in about early January 2015 said, I think you need to see neurology. And so I made that appointment. Thankfully, the next day they'd had a cancellation, so I was able to get in right away, which was pretty unusual. And I remember calling my physical therapist, her name is Laura, and saying to her how frightened I was. And she said to me, Nikki, whatever has happened to your body is done, and we just need to figure out what it is so we can work through it. And in that moment, it's kind of in my mind, I'm like, well, of course, she just made me see it with greater clarity. And so throughout the month of January, I went through the different diagnostic procedures, the MRIs, the spinal tap. And at the end of January 2015, I received the diagnosis of relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. And so that was a shock. But that is how I got to the diagnosis. The story doesn't end there, but that's the diagnosis story.
Yeah, so while we're with that, are there more than one different type of MS?
Yeah, and the way this is being defined is changing as well, but they really think through four different types of MS. One is clinically isolated, where there's one attack, if you will, and there's no chronic condition that develops. Then there's relapsing remitting MS, in which and about 85% of the MS population is diagnosed with this type of MS to start. And it's where you go through periods. It sounds like remission, but it's not remission because MS never goes away. There's never really a true remitting period for people with MS, but you do have acute relapses. So what I was describing with my leg giving out from under me and really not knowing where that right leg was in space, basically, that was a relapse. And so you go through where the disease is really active, there's inflammation in your body that's causing this attack to happen, the lesions or the sclerosis to form. And so that's relapsing remitting. The third is secondary progressive MS. So about 50% of those diagnosed with relapsing remitting will eventually transition into secondary progressive. And that's where the relapses become less frequent, but the disability symptoms increase, where there's this is where it becomes more difficult to walk. There may be other, you just move up in the disability scale, if you will. And then the fourth type is called primary progressive, which is where the disability progresses really quickly from the start of diagnosis. So those are the four types of MS.
So the first type you mentioned, is it like they have an incident or whatever you'd call it, and never again then?
Yeah, it's just an event where there aren't a lot of signs of MS, from the clinical standpoint. And so it's just considered an isolated instance. And again, I think they're taking, to be honest, I don't know a lot about the different protocols, but in my sort of cursory reading of it, I think that is one that they're not investing as much time in now and kind of thinking about the different types even differently. So,
but if you did a scan on them, would you find the same, myelin gone, it would the same scarring or whatever as you would on anybody with MS?
I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Well, certainly four different, and you have the second.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about, that must have been pretty devastating for you. Where were you in your life with that? Did you have kids? Did mm-hmm. you? How was that for you?
Yeah, it was quite a shock. So I have two children. One is a senior in high school, and the other is a freshman in high school. And at the time of diagnosis, they were 13 and 10. I had just switched jobs, so I'd been in my job about a year and a half, and mm-hmm. Was really, you know, again, I was running. I was like, you know, I was a runner, and things were really great. I've been married to my husband for 20 years. We're actually high school sweethearts, so I've known him for a lot longer than that.
That's so sweet.
And I sometimes think that if we can survive senior prom together, we can survive MS together. So, you know, and I guess it really was such a shock to the system. I mean, you're just... And I just didn't know a lot about MS. And it was just this uncertainty and the weight of it. And, you know, it's not a life-threatening disease, but it is definitely life-altering. I mean, you just are left with this. The doctors really can't tell you, you know, what's going to be the progression of your disease. They can't tell you whether you'll be able to run again, if you'll walk again, if certain symptoms will die down. They, when you're diagnosed, they kind of say, we just have to kind of watch and see what happens. And so it's just kind of scary because you don't know if you need to modify your house, if you need to think about your work situation, how is it going to impact our financial future, the kids. I mean, just everything kind of comes weighing down on you pretty fast and furious. And so it was a very overwhelming time.
How did you introduce it to your kids?
You know, so I made the decision when I started having symptoms and everything not to give a name to it. They were watching me, and certainly there was something different about me mm-hmm. in terms of struggling to really control that leg and just not feeling great. But because I didn't have a definitive diagnosis, I didn't want to put something out there that was not going to be the case and have to change it. So once I was officially diagnosed, mm-hmm. We just sat them down and shared it with them and just shared that we didn't know a lot either, that we had a lot of questions that were open-ended. One really funny thing is my son, again, he was 13 at the time, he said, I knew it was MS. As soon as you went for the spinal tap, I knew it was MS because we learned about it in biology.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, he had this knowledge. I feel badly thinking about him having that on his mind during that really, you know, that diagnostic process was really scary. I mean, they watched me go through the symptoms of mm-hmm. a spinal headache and, you know, all these different things I was going through. And so that's really how we introduced it. And my daughter, the next day, she said, I asked her if she was feeling scared, and she said that she wasn't scared, that she knew I was okay because I was in the hands of God. And that was her sort of belief system shining through and her mm-hmm. way of thinking about it. And so they really responded in very what I would expect of them. And so that was their experience being introduced to MS.
Did you have family or friends that you had seen go through any of this before, or was this your first kind of introduction to it?
Well, in a very, this is so fascinating to me. So when I was going through symptoms, my husband said, you know, I'm not a betting man, but if I were to run the numbers, the chances of you having MS are so low because Erica, one of my best friends, has MS. So, and she's there's four of us that are very, very close. And, he's like, what would that be, you know, to have two of the, we all went to college together.
Right,
you know?
Right.
He's like, what are the chances that two out of the four of you would have MS? But good thing he didn't place a
good
bet.
Good thing he didn't.
Yeah. So I'd been introduced to my friend who had been diagnosed about, really only 4 years prior to my diagnosis. And again, her experience is very different. And so, I think back on that and think, you know, I really didn't understand what she was going through at that time. And, but certainly we've been each other's, you know, close support through all this, as have all my friends, but we have that, we can talk in shorthand. you know, so we, and, So that was really my first close experience. You know, I knew people growing up that had MS, you know, friends with my mom and other things like that, but I hadn't seen the real impact of the disease until I was diagnosed.
Does MS run in families?
So they don't know, and that's where a lot of research is focusing, because they do think there's a hereditary component to it, and I have certainly heard a lot of stories of moms and daughters or moms and sons, and so there is a component, but they don't consider it to be a hugely genetic condition. But certainly something that when you have a parent with any neurological condition, that you're watching that and making sure that there's really nothing you can do to prevent MS, but just making sure maintaining a you know healthy immune system, for example. But yeah, so that's all they really know. It's a big mystery.
Now your kids are kind of in the teenage years.
Uh-huh.
How are they pretty good about dealing with this with their friends? I mean, obviously, it's a topic.
Right. You know, they deal with it differently. My son is a more private person just overall. Mm-hmm. So I think he, you know, he copes with it in that way. My daughter, we do the MS walk every year, and she has friends that have done it every single year with us, which is really awesome. And, but I, you know, they each just... it's just beautiful how they respond to it. So I'll just tell a quick story. My son was the marching band drum major last year. And so I had told him that I wanted to walk a parade before he graduated, because I just haven't felt comfortable walking parades with him, because my leg is still pretty weak and I worry about falling or tripping and messing up the parade route. And I would just be devastated if I embarrassed him in that way. And so I walked a parade with him in June, and he actually gave a speech and said to the entire marching band and all of their staff that it was a special parade because his mom, who had MS and had made this goal, and that I had walked with him that day and to, you know, thank me and congratulate me. And very special moment. I mean, aww, to have him do that was just amazing. And sometimes the impacts on them are really... hidden from me, because I think, you know, they try and be really strong. But my daughter wrote a paper about how there was a day where she worried that she would never dance in the kitchen with her mom again.
Aww.
And that she had. And so, and I, you know, it was so wonderful for her to share that with me. But, you know, some of that I just didn't see. So they, I think it is really, they've always been empathetic and compassionate kids, but I think it's just they look at things differently as a result of having a mom with MS, and hopefully, you know, it shapes them in a good way, as well as also learning how to deal with adversity.
Excellent. Nikki, can you let's talk about statistics. So do you have national and statistics for Minnesota?
Yeah, the MS Society just released in the last few weeks an updated number of people living with MS in the United States. And that updated number is now almost 1 million people living in the U.S. with MS.
Okay.
And that is almost twice as many, or it is twice as many as before. The last study was done in 1975, which is almost, you know, 45 years ago.
That's a little out of date.
A little bit. And so the number used to be 400,000. And so the MS Society invested in this study to really get a better sense of the number of people living with MS. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, it was a very rigorous study. I think it may also be an undercount again. I mean, there's limits on what data could be used to identify this number. But it does give us an even greater sense of urgency around, you know, finding a cure, finding solutions to deal with the symptoms and treatments, all that, just knowing the number. And the other thing that the MS Society has worked on is the development of a national neurological disease surveillance system, where there would be data collected around neurological conditions. And so that was passed. It was called the 21st Century's Cure Act in 2016. And in 2018, appropriated funds. So it was funded through the CDC, or the Centers for Disease Control. And MS and Parkinson's are the two diseases that they've put to the top of the priority list in terms of starting to track that. And it will really help accelerate our understanding of the disease, meaning are there geographic clusters? Are there other factors that might be environmental in nature or other things that would just help to gain a little bit more insight into a disease that is just so so mysterious. And so that's really great progress. As far as numbers in Minnesota, one estimate is that there's 353 people for every 100,000 people in the Midwest that has MS, and that's one of the highest rates, incidence rates in the country.
Really?
So, yeah.
So it's actually higher in Minnesota.
Yeah, in the Midwest, yep.
In the Midwest.
Midwest and the Northeast are the two parts of the country that have the most MS.
Any idea why?
So this is, it's really fascinating. It's, they think there's a link between vitamin D and MS because vitamin D is so critical to our immune system. And so in places like Minnesota or Maine, you're not spending quite as much time outside. Just look at the nearly 40 inches of snow that we've had in February as to why.
I thought about sunbathing out there today, but
right.
Exactly.
And so that lack of exposure to the sunlight could be create vitamin D deficiencies. I know at one point in my history that my vitamin D level was really low. This was pre-diagnosis, so that is one thing that they suspect is that vitamin D piece. And so when you were asking about the genetic part of it, when I was first diagnosed, I asked a neurologist if I should, make sure my kids take vitamin D, kind of keep their vitamin D levels up. And he said to me, my kids don't have an MS family member, but I make sure they have, 2,000 IUDs a day or however much it was, mm-hmm. Just that it's just good for good immune system health. And so, and I think just some of this, refining the system used to track it will just get us even greater insights into it. But, Minnesota is one place where it is really, really prevalent.
Huh. Interesting. I did not know at all.
Yeah.
Is there a gender preference?
So, definitely not a discriminating disease, so it affects everyone. But they do find that it's more common in females. I don't know the exact number, but it is more common in women.
Let's talk about age range.
Mm-hmm.
What have you seen or known for this?
Yeah. So it's typically between 25 and 40 when people are diagnosed. And when you think about the impact on that population, I just met a young woman earlier this week, and she was telling me a story of how much it impacted the direction of her life at the age of 26. So it really is often diagnosed at a young age. That also means that you live with the disease for a long time since it's not life-threatening, and so it has a lot of impacts. So it's typically, like I said, like that 25 to 40, 45 age range. Mm-hmm. I know that when I went to see my neurologist, that was one thing that she had said was, you're kind of in this age target. You're a woman. This is why I'm thinking about MS for you. So, but there are incidences of pediatric MS. And
is that the same as juvenile MS?
Oh, I haven't heard it referred to that way, but yes.
I thought I saw something with that, but
okay.
It could have been meaning something different. But.
No, yeah, it's probably the same. It's not very common, but it does happen. There's a lot of exciting research, and they actually just approved the first treatment for pediatric MS, which is great. I have some friends that were older in life. So it does range, but it's typically in that younger age range. So.
I would presume that if it's pediatric MS that somebody gets, that would be a real almost disaster as far as what a long time to have to deal with that.
Right. Yeah. It's hard, but there's a young woman who has, and I'm going to fail to remember all the details, but she's created a stuffed animal specific for kids that are diagnosed with MS.
Okay.
And it travels, Oscar, and it travels to different MS events, and you take your picture with Oscar, and it's orange. Orange is the MS awareness color, and so So I think there's a lot of hope, especially with having a treatment that is now approved for that age range. I mean, that is just so important in MS. So so I think there's a lot of hope. And that's one thing that I would say about the MS community that is just amazing, is you just meet so many people that take the diagnosis and create something bigger than themselves, like Oscar, you know, that travels around and is meant to give hope and joy to kids diagnosed with MS.
And do you know much about that part of the MS?
The treatment?
With kids diagnosed, like how do they fare and how is their journey different as far as like symptoms and things like that?
You know, I'm sorry, I don't know much about that, so okay. I apologize.
That's okay. I didn't realize they had that young of, you know, but right. I guess there's a lot of things that can happen there.
Mm-hmm.
So, it sounds like, you know, looking at rate of progression, it sounds like, I guess with the four, there's four of them or mm-hmm. five?
Four. Yep.
Kind of, will you break it down again? Well, I guess not, you don't have to do the first one because that's a single, but the other three.
Sure.
Like what might be the rate of progression? I realize there's going to be differences, but.
Right. And so it is just really different with everybody. And so there are people that, and maybe it's almost thinking about it in terms of an aggressive scale. You know, there mm-hmm. are people that have in a more aggressive form of relapsing remitting MS. So for example, for me, within my first year of diagnosis, I saw an MS specialist, and she actually came in and first thing she said to me was, you have an aggressive form of this disease and you need to be on a more aggressive medication. So they can kind of look at things like where the lesions are placed. So for me, I had a lesion on my spinal cord, which is impacts the ability to walk a lot more, which they want to try and stop if they can so that you maintain mobility. So there's almost like there is kind of an unscientific scale of aggressiveness of the disease, and whether people with relapsing remitting can, you know, transition into this secondary progressive, but they don't know why or how or if that will happen for you. So I just saw my doctor speak at a dinner event, and she was saying they're trying to do more research on that secondary progressive because they'd like to find treatments, because in that case, then your disability level goes up, you know, quicker. And so the progression just is really so individual. And I think it varies. One of the indicators that my doctor shared with me is how well you recover from a relapse. So for example, for me, another quick story.
We love stories.
When I was diagnosed, I just was so determined that I was going to run again. That just became this goal. And so I went to physical therapy, you know, religiously. I just was, and I dedicated myself to that physical therapy. I was able to get on a different drug when that doctor said, you need a more aggressive medication. I was placed on another drug that helps me walk. And the kids and I actually kept it a secret from everybody. And I registered for a 5K in June of 2017. So this is about two years after my diagnosis. And the reason I didn't tell anyone else is I thought if I woke up and I said, you know what, I just don't feel well today, because it can be a day by day disease, right?
Yes.
So if I don't feel well, the kids will be like, yay, we get to sleep in for 2 hours. And so they wouldn't judge that. But I was able to do it. I wasn't able to run from start to finish. I ran maybe half or a little bit less than half of it, but I was running, right? And I was able to do it. And that was a huge accomplishment. And so because of that sort of level of recovery, my doctor feels really good that my prognosis is good. It's always going to be uncertain. There's always going to be a giant question mark in everyone's mind, but including mine. And I really hope that I don't have another relapse or another event. But, you know, that's one thing that they look to in order to determine sort of how the progression will be for you. So
that is kind of your MS, mm-hmm. is that it's, you know, comes and goes, so to speak.
Right.
So you don't, it is really that, you don't, unknowing.
Yeah. And it's not, as far as coming and going, I mean, I have symptoms every day, all day that will.
That reminds you, I'm still here.
Yeah. Until there's a cure, until we figure out how to remyelinate those frayed nerves, mm-hmm. I will always feel spasticity. So that's where my muscles just feel really tight from my, you know, but my midsection down. You know, I won't regain full feeling in my right leg. I will always have physical reactions to stress. So I can actually, you know, the numbness and tingling comes back when I am stressed or I haven't had enough sleep.
I was reading something on that mm-hmm. stress can kind of impact things.
Yeah. And the fatigue will be stronger, or my thinking might be a little bit muddier. And so it's not, it really never goes away. I think some people have quieter symptoms, certainly. But for most people with MS, it's a day-by-day battle, even when the disease isn't actively attacking my immune system. It's still, it definitely reminds me. That's a good way to think about it. It's like, it doesn't go away.
yeah, that would be hard. And always living with that unknowing mm-hmm. would be stress in itself.
Right.
How did you learn to keep that stress at bay?
You know, it's a work in progress.
I bet it is.
And it is. So for me, it's very important that I keep going, right? That mm-hmm. I do as much of awareness building as I can, that volunteer work that I do with the MS Society, coordinating the Walk MS team, all of those things. But I need to learn to say no a little bit more, be realistic. The other thing that has really helped me in terms of the stress and trying to put the MS, you know, trying to kick it out of my brain a little bit, mm-hmm. is just really stopping and noticing everything that I'm so grateful for every single day. You know, it's listening to my daughter's orchestra concert and the beautiful music. It's, you know, being able to walk the dog for a couple miles. You know, all these things that may just, they're everyday things, but I'm so grateful to have that day, you know, because that day I felt well enough to do those things. And so when you kind of take that practice of thinking at the end of the day of everything that went right, mm-hmm. Then some of what might go wrong isn't top of mind. So that's one way that I've thought about it.
So let's talk about treatments.
Sure.
And I know you came from a big event not too long ago. So I don't know how you want to separate that or if you want to talk about that all in one.
Okay.
But you take it away.
Great. So this is what is so exciting about the MS movement right now. In the 90s, the first treatment was introduced in the 90s. I mean, and so there's been MS for a lot longer than that. So that was the first treatment. And thanks to research by the MS Society, by other researchers, through NIH funding, today we have 14 treatments. And most of that growth has been in the last 5 to 10 years. And so they work in very different ways. And it's really depending on how your MS is going, what the prognosis is, how the doctor may want to treat it. And it may be something where you start one treatment and it stops working, or it never starts working, one of the two, and they switch you. But to have that many options is really, really amazing. And 2 years ago, actually, the first treatment for primary progressive MS was introduced into the market, which is fantastic because there hadn't been before then. All the other treatments were for relapsing, remitting, and so to have one for the MS community that is, you know, really impacted to a different degree, have a treatment option is fantastic. And they're making strides in finding a treatment for secondary progressive. Now, again, these aren't cures, but what they do is really slow the progression of the disease and hopefully prevent, you know, future disability that's going to impact you. So they do help in with some symptoms, but really symptoms are managed more with other drugs or there may not be anything to address it. But what I am so thankful for is because they have this new treatment that was introduced 2 years ago, I was able to still stay on a pretty strong medication when I needed to make a switch. I had started on one, developed some risk factors for pretty serious side effects. And there was an option that could keep me at that level because I didn't want to take a step down. You know, I said to the doctor, my kids are in the house for at least another 4 years,
right?
You know, and I want to be as good as I am today, as you know, for the next, at least the next 4 years, if not forever.
Right.
And so she was able to keep me at that level, which is really great. And so I was at an event this week. We were, the National MS Society held their annual public policy conference in DC. It's the second time I've been honored to attend this event. And so I was joined by 300 other MS activists in across the country. And we talked through different policy priorities to really help advance the MS, MS policies, MS research, all those things that are just so important. And one of the things that we advocated for was increased funding for MS and really just all conditions. So we advocated for an increase in funding for National Institutes of Health, as well as there's...
Yes.
There's one program that is specific to MS because for NIH funding, we really look at supporting everybody, you know,
right.
That there's really good benefits from all advances in medical research.
And NIH does a lot.
Yes. Yeah.
So.
And so we were advocating for an increase in funding for something called the MS Research Program that actually comes from the Department of Defense, which doesn't...
Huh, really?
A little,
okay.
I would not have thought that, but okay
there's
then.
There's a connection, MS and veterans, I believe.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, and the recent prevalence study that I shared earlier where they found that 1 million number, that study found there's 70,000 vets with MS. And so that is why they have this MS research program for the Department of Defense. And so it was great. I was sitting in one congressional office and they said, I need to hear about this MS research program, because I was just talking to representatives from the VFW who said people with MS are here, you know, advocating for a policy they want to see. So it was great to have that kind of connection on that day. And so the other thing that we were talking about was affordable and accessible healthcare and eliminating surprise billing. So if you go into a clinic and one of the people in the supply chain, the radiologist reading your MRI, for example, is out of your network and not covered by your insurance, you might get a surprise bill that is a lot higher than you were anticipating. So we'd like to eliminate that surprise billing through greater transparency or some other processes that makes that clearer when you go into a medical facility, especially
right.
in an emergency
right.
situation when,
oh, yes.
you know, you're...
Yes.
Everybody's having that problem, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then the last one, and again, I mean, these issues really do... go beyond people with MS is the increasing drug prices. And so really looking at, we had a slate of legislation that we were talking with congressmen about, congressmen and women about, and that was, you know, around how to rein in those prices. Because as I mentioned earlier, people with MS live with it for a long time, so have that financial
right.
impact.
Yeah.
And the median price for MS medications is over $88,000 a year. I take a pill to help me with my walking. I mentioned it earlier. The generic form of that pill is $1,300 a month.
Oh, my God.
You know, and I have employer-sponsored health care. So there has to be a way to ensure that there are more generics on the market and just that there's more transparency in why these drugs are increasing in price, especially given, you know, there's been increased supply, if you will. We now have 14 medications, but those drug costs are just going up, and the research isn't what they're investing in, as far as we can tell. So what is causing those 10%, 15%, 20% annual increases? So
I do want to point out that you are lucky enough to keep working.
Yes.
There are people with MS who have to stop work.
Right. Absolutely.
So yep. Where does their coverage come from then?
Yeah. I mean, there's a variety of insurance, you know, options for them depending on their situation. But, you know, and that's something that we talk about. We always want to touch on all the different types of insurance to make
right.
sure that that people are covered and have access to affordable. And especially with drug prices, you know, one of the things that we think about is it's great that there's been innovation and advancement. We want to see that continue. But if people can't access the medication, then that, you know, and they can't afford it.
That's the next thing yeah. that needs to be dealt with,
yes.
actually, I think.
Yeah. And I think I'm feeling optimistic. And I know it's just because I've only been back from D.C. for 48 hours. So all that optimism and hope on Capitol Hill. But, you know, I think It was an amazing conference. I met a woman who has been talking a lot about Medicare drug pricing because she had to stop taking her MS medications when she went on Medicare. It just was not financially feasible. And she was actually invited to the State of the Union by Senator Baldwin in Wisconsin. But Diane said to the group, you know, telling my story gives this disease a purpose. And so I feel really inspired and excited about the advocacy work that we did this week.
I have a friend who has MS, and mm-hmm. one of her frustrations is that there's some drugs out there that they think will work, mm-hmm. but they're so slow to approve them, and they can't be used until the insurance company, you know, because the insurance company won't pay for them. It's just, it's very a very frustrating situation.
Yeah, and oftentimes what happens is the insurance company will mandate that you fail on certain drugs before they'll approve, you know, a more expensive one.
Yeah.
And so a lot of advocacy, because I do a lot of advocacy work locally here in Minnesota too, and have to give a shout out to any government relations committee members listening today, because an amazing group of people have worked together to advance some of this. And something that we talk about is that decision should be the doctors and the patients, not the insurance companies.
I would
and
agree.
So there's been some progress on that, and so we have to keep moving that forward. But I know it's also a frustration in the medical community as well when a neurologist has that person's, you know, brain, if you will, in their hand, and there's not time. You want to prevent any further degeneration.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes you wonder whose side they're on.
Right.
So it's been, what, 5-6 years, right, since your diagnosis?
Four, actually.
Four. Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. That's not even... So where do you get your strength that you draw upon? How do you feel like you're doing from, comparatively speaking, from the beginning?
Sure. I feel like I've got a better sense of this disease in terms of mm-hmm. how it's going to impact my life, how to manage it. It's always with that sort of asterisk saying it could change tomorrow, but I have to just think about it for today. I draw my strength from, you know, definitely my family and friends who have been so supportive through this entire journey and have really rallied, you know, through doing the walks with me and all of that. And just my kids when I'm having a bad day and telling someone, oh, it's not going that great, they'll say, but remember yesterday you walked 3 miles. They kind of hold that mirror up pretty close and make sure I'm thinking of the positive things.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, I just can't say enough about the positive nature of the MS community and the opportunities I've had to interact with people across the country here locally. And so I could draw a lot of strength from them because individuals I meet often are facing challenges that I don't yet have, or, you know, I'm trying to prevent, and just the just never ending positivity and how do we make the best of this situation and make change for everybody. It's just so inspiring. I can't say enough about it. And one of the individuals that spoke at the conference this week said the reason that he does this advocacy work is he brings the voice of urgency to a community that needs a cure. Mm. And so this story and my journey, yes, I want positive outcomes for me, but it's really about making a change for the entire MS community. And that feels like something bigger than myself that I can draw on and remember. And it's another piece where, you know, when I was first diagnosed, I just thought to myself, my kids are watching every move I make. And they're going to learn so much in this journey. How do I make sure that they learn the positive side? You know, it's not that I sugarcoat things or we don't talk about the challenges or there aren't tears every once in a while when I'm having a bad day. It's just that how can we work together with other people to raise money for MS or do this advocacy work? And they've really gotten engaged in it. So that's really where the strength comes is from that and just the overall MS community and hope. I remember... This sounds really silly, but my first MS walk, and I really wasn't walking very well. I actually have this good friend, Natalia. She was pretty young at the time. I think she was maybe 9. She held my hand the entire walk.
Aww.
You know, and just looking out at the crowd of people and all the people that were there supporting people with MS and just thinking, you know, it's going to be okay. That was the moment where I just knew it was going to be okay, that there were going to be tough days, but I was going to, you know, use the muscle memory that I had on how to get out of that that relapse or that bad day where my head's just swirling with all the scenarios. So that MS community is a really strong one and very powerful.
Any words of wisdom to somebody who's newly diagnosed?
You know, reach out to the MS Society, and they, I unbelievable resource. They have something called Knowledge is Power, where they send.
That's true.
Yep. They send information about MS, but they don't do it all at once. And it like comes to you in, you know, a certain cycle and schedule of every couple of weeks. You might get something about thinking about MS and work or MS in your relationships, and just overall MS knowledge. And that was really helpful because it's such an overwhelming diagnosis where you just stopped in your tracks and like, what am I going to do next?
And makes you think they should do that with all diagnoses.
I agree. Big. Yeah. And it just was, it just really helped. And then there's also something called MS Navigators. And so you can call and they will answer any and all questions. The one that I called, her name was literally Hope. And and so, and she helped me with some employment accommodation issues. Mm. If you're struggling financially to pay a bill, they will help find resources in your local community. And so I would just say, you know, leverage that national resource as much as possible. And, you know, listen to other people that have been on this journey, but honor your own story at the same time. You know, take the lessons that they've learned and just see if it fits for you, because it is just so different for everyone. So just know that I love this line I learned this week too. I am the leading expert of my MS, and think about that and then just learn as much as possible and rely on family and friends that want to help. And you know, that's how you get through it, and know that you will get through it.
So where can someone find out more about MS?
So it's the National MS Society website would be really great place to start. And I meant to look up the actual address before I came tonight, and I forgot.
So you can Google, though.
But you can Google it.
National.
That's how I found you.
yeah, right. the National MS Society, or, you know, I know that my doctor really said, you know, a good resource is always the Mayo Clinic. If the information there is really... Mm-hmm. You know, it's verified and that's a good resource.
Right.
And so those are the things I didn't do this shockingly. I didn't do a ton of research other than those two resources, just because, you know, what you find
Could be totally overwhelming.
Exactly. And scary. You know, you might hear something really bad. But there are some great podcasts out there. There's one called Real Talk MS, run by two people in Ohio with MS, and some other things like that, that eventually, over time, you know, take it and give yourself time to learn and cope and move forward.
If somebody is concerned, like if they say, you know, I want to donate or something, but I really want to make sure like my money goes to the maximum amount of helping and not paying for overhead stuff.
Right.
How can they find out how to do that?
So, you know, I think you want to look and kind of look at a track record of an organization.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly like with the National MS Society, I mean, over the course of the society, they've invested over $1 billion into research. I mean, they're really a private partner, if you will, with the government on this research.
Okay.
And I've asked a question about how much of each dollar goes to research, and that's I think it's 83%, or you know, it's in the 80s. And then the other dollars go to services for people with MS, the MS Navigators, for example. And so I think donating to, you know, finding a team that's walking for Walk MS or other things like that, you know, everyone has their own comfort level, but just kind of take a look at the track record and talk to people that are experiencing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Is it really a good resource, for example?
Right.
And see. So.
Well, Nikki, it's been awesome.
Great.
You're going to come on in another 4 years, right?
I would love to. You know what? I want to come when there's a cure. Can I tell
you? You
like,
absolutely okay. Can. You just mark okay. the time.
We'll just put it on the calendar.
Yeah, right.
4 years from this, the first Thursday in March.
Hey, I'm feisty. I'll make it happen.
Exactly.
<I'm just kidding. laughs>
anything you'd like to leave us with?
No.
Why don't you talk about that walk when it is again and how people can people still get involved?
Absolutely. So it's free to register and there's no, you know, sort of requirement to fundraise to be a part of it. And yes, there's plenty of time to register even up to the day of the event. It's May 5th, Minnehaha Park. And you can learn more on the National MS Society website. I guess what I would leave you with is just gratitude for a wonderful conversation and thanks for continuing to help raise awareness about MS, because I think the awareness is what drives the research, what drives the funding. And so this is really great that we have this resource in the Minneapolis community. Thank you.
Thank you for coming on. It's people like you that make it work, and know that tell your people pledges coming up for KFAI, so the March 21st and 28th through the, you know, the for our show anyway.
Great.
This is how we work. So thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
Good night. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you'd like to be in our email list, you may email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. That's disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Charlene Dahl is my research woman, and we've been speaking with Nikki Foster about MS or multiple sclerosis tonight. Good night.
KFAI.org.